So thanks very much for inviting me here today. Get out of little Norwich into the big capital. So I apologise, I'm still getting used to doing talks with reading specs, so I'm sorry if my face will be in my notes a lot of the time. Okay. So I'll just launch into it, really. The Buddha. So that's who we're here to talk about, to worship today. And in some ways, I've had difficulty with the Buddha over the years. On my ordination, order members are given a visualization practice on their ordination, and I chose to visualize the Buddha. I chose to visualize the Buddha as my practice. It just seemed obvious in a way, like the Buddha, Buddhism, visualizing the Buddha every day. It just seemed appropriate. And I did the practice for 2 years every day, and I didn't really get anywhere with it. I just couldn't connect with it. And I'm still not quite sure why that was. But part of the reason, perhaps, was because the Buddha seemed both too near, in a way. He was, you know, a historical human figure in some ways, like me, but he wasn't quite like me, and too far away as well. You know, he was fully enlightened, it just seemed too far over the horizon. So between those two poles, I was trying to connect with the Buddha, and finding it very difficult. And as Maitreya Raja says, I write plays for the radio, and suggested to a producer that I write a play about the story of the Buddha, and I was really excited by that, and he seemed quite interested, and he said, all right, write me a few sample scenes. So I wrote some sample scenes, and again I found it really difficult. On the one hand, I was writing these, I tried to do it in a kind of Glasgow dialect first of all, make it really kind of folksy and earthy, but that didn't work. It just sounded too familiar and a little bit coarse or something like that. And then I went to the opposite extreme. I tried to do something which was a little bit more lyrical and formal and, you know, my lord and all the rest of it. But that just sounded really dull and aloof. So, unfortunately, I never managed to get the style that I wanted. But hopefully one day I'll be able to do that. But yeah, the connection is perhaps necessarily problematic. And I'm sure kind of artists in the movement, Chintamani, Alaka, or the rest of them, have found a similar difficulty, particularly maybe with the face of the Buddha. You don't want to make it too human, and you don't want to make it too aloof either. So added to that, I'm not somebody to whom devotion comes easy. I was brought up in the Church of Scotland, and I kind of tend to associate worship with... Well, I won't go into... I don't want to rant on for too long, but... Yeah, I've always struggled with worship, and I've always struggled with puja. So what I'm saying is I'm not at all naturally devotional. So at this point, Maitreya Raja's heart begins to sink, and he thinks, I've got the wrong guy for the Buddha job. But don't walk out just yet, because I do feel devotion, often strong devotion for the Buddha. But I've had to work at it. I've had to really work at it, and a lot of that work has been to do with firstly reflecting on the story and the legend of the Buddha, and secondly making connections with the story of the Buddha and all the Western literature and art, etc., that I've loved over the years. So what I want to do this afternoon, really, is just look at the story of the Buddha and make some connections between that story, between the Buddha, and just some of the literature and poetry and so on which resonates with me. And I hope it resonates with you and, well, just brings the Buddha more directly into our hearts today. And this is all quite current, really, because Sangharakshita, who found the movement, and Subhuti, one of Sangharakshita's chief disciples, have been talking a lot about the imagination and the importance of making imaginative connections and links with the Buddha, with the figure of the Buddha. Because for the Buddha to be truly alive for us, we need to make these imaginative links between the figure of the Buddha, between the story of the Buddha, and all those, the music, the imagery, and the stories which really move us deeply. We've got to make those links. And it does take a bit of work. We've not grown up Well, most of us, I presume, haven't grown up with the story of the Buddha. It wasn't told to us as children. It's not ingrained. We're really bringing two traditions together. We're bringing together this Eastern tradition, which we've adopted or are in the process of adopting, and our own culture. So a way into devotion for me was the legend of the Buddha, the story of the Buddha. And I tend to favour stories and words over music and art and so on. You know, this is where I connect most strongly, through stories and drama. Though I do respond to images. And you could say theatre, in a way, is a kind of series of kind of stage pictures. But before I get started in myth and story, I would like to talk about one image that I really respond to. And this is the painting which Alaka, an order member called Alaka, painted for the Norwich Buddhist Centre. So Alaka is the same artist who did the lovely image downstairs in the basement. So the Norwich Buddhist Centre moved buildings about 6 years ago, and we wanted an image really appropriate for that space. So I was given the enviable job of liaising with Alaka, and we just talked a lot. We talked about the space, we talked about the Buddha, we talked about Norwich. Originally I wanted Norwich to look like Norwich, but he thought that would not be a good idea, and I think he was utterly right. You know, you don't want to see Specsavers or whatever in the image of the Buddha. So he wanted a more kind of mythical and in a sense abstract image. We talked about you know, Middle Ages in Norwich and kind of town plans, and he came up with something which was I think it's really beautiful, and did manage to combine a kind of Eastern tradition with a kind of Western tradition as well. And looking at it now, I can see little echoes of the conversations we had, you know, the stories we talked about, the images, because Alaka really emphasised the fact that his commissions are very much kind of collaborations, really. And you can really see that in that particular image. So I think it has a real resonance for Westerners. You know, in a certain way, we made the Buddha ours. And Alaka said that if, as a movement, we don't eventually give birth to our own compelling symbolic forms, we will not survive as a vehicle for the Dharma. If as a movement, we don't eventually give birth to our own compelling symbolic forms, we will not survive as a vehicle for the Dharma. And I don't think Alaka just meant when he talked of compelling symbolic forms, you know, the pictorial image. Though obviously this is his own emphasis. You know, we could also talk in terms of the necessity of connecting with and creating music, poetry, stories, myth and drama which imaginatively resonate for us as modern Buddhists and as a modern Buddhist movement. So if we think of the life of the Buddha, it might not appear immediately dramatic. You know, drama famously is about conflict. And where's the conflict in the life of the Buddha? He wasn't a riven being. He wasn't divided. The Buddha wasn't somebody who doubted his own mission. Except, of course, in the life of the Buddha, there is a period of great conflict, of great drama, when he sees the four sights, the famous four sights of the Buddha, and they're kind of shattering. He's thrown into conflict, and after much soul searching, he goes forth from the palace into the forest. And this, in a way, is where the Buddha's life really touches our own. This conflict between the worldly life and the spiritual life, in a way you couldn't get a situation more dramatic. Should he embrace the success and the pleasure and the love and the ambition and the power, which are his for the taking? Or should he risk losing everything and everybody? You know, risk losing his life, his sanity, risk really wounding terribly the people he holds most dear. And he knew that, you know, the forest floor was littered with the bones of those who'd gone before him, who'd gone off into the forest in search of the truth and had never returned. Can you all hear me, by the way? I can. Yeah? Okay. So I do a lot of school visits. And no matter the age of the kids, whether they're primary kids or senior kids, I invariably start with the story of the Buddha. I always start with that. And as well as talking about the Buddha and enlightenment, I really concentrate on the four sights and the going forth, the four sights of the Buddha and the going forth. So I'll set things up. I'll tell them that you know, Siddhartha was born into a warrior clan, and he trained as a soldier, he trained as a warrior, swordsmanship, horsemanship, all the rest of it. He had absolutely everything he could possibly want. So I, you know, get responses. What is it that you most value in your life? What are all the things you'd really love to have? So I'll talk about things, all the things Siddhartha had, the beautiful clothes, the rings, the food. And we go into great detail about the food. And that his father kept him in the palace. He didn't want him to leave the palace. He had everything in the palace that he could possibly want, and his father insisted that he didn't leave the palace and go into the city. But eventually, of course, Siddhartha became bored. And again, I emphasise that, the boredom of Siddhartha. He just became bored with his life, and he got into his chariot. You know what a chariot is? Tell me what a chariot is. And he went into the city. And what do you think he saw in the city? And a recent visit, I was really pleased because they just got it. You know, they talked about poverty and violence, but somebody said old age, yeah, so old age. Somebody said sickness, yeah, and somebody said death. You know, they got the whole lot, really, and they hadn't heard the story of Siddhartha before. He saw old age, sickness, and death, and the sights were really shattering. And in a previous school visit, after my talk, I asked if there were any questions. And these children, I don't think they could have been any older than 5 or 6. You know, they were infants. They might even have been younger. I can't remember now. I do remember having lunch with them and sitting in these tiny little plastic chairs. Probably traumatizing them. I'm sure they reckon that Buddhists are, you know, they associate Buddhists forevermore with huge, giant, hairy Scotsmen. But anyway, after I talked about the story of the Buddha, I asked if there were any questions, and somebody could ask, well, what's death like? So I tried to answer that one, and then they said, what does it feel like to be dead? And I failed to ask that one. Does everybody die? Yep, everybody dies. Do you go into the dark when you die? And like every question was about death. And I thought I'd really blown it. And I apologised to the teacher afterwards, and I said, well, maybe I emphasised that element too much, or maybe I shouldn't have mentioned it at all. But she said, no, it's fine, you know. They're just really obsessed with death at that age. I don't know if she meant those particular children. I don't think so. I think she meant generally just children in generally, but I don't, you know, not being a parent, I don't know. But anyway, they, you know, they were very, very interested in death, and every single question was about death. And that's the thing about the first three sights, about old age, sickness, and death. They don't represent suffering in any abstract sense. You know, they're visceral. You know, they're so immediate that a 5-year-old can understand why Siddhartha was so upset by these sights. And of course, as we get older, we see these sights more and more clearly. So I've been reading a lot of Russian literature recently, and a cultural history of Russia. And I was really struck with the suffering during Stalin's time, during the Great Terror. The number of writers, for example, who were destroyed, you know, literally killed, or who committed suicide, or went mad, or were, you know, severely compromised because of Stalin and his regime. You know, it's truly tragic. The writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in one of his novels, Stalin's a character in the novel, and there's a great sentence in it, like, everything Stalin touched turned to mediocrity, which I think is brilliant, this huge mediocrity. But Stalin did understand the power of the image, because, of course, for the Russians, the icon was the kind of centre of their religious faith. They kind of worshipped the icon. During Stalin's time, the icons were destroyed, and in the place of the icon was placed Stalin's picture. You know, so all that devotion would go towards the leader. Anyway, a lot of these writers, and, you know, many, many people at that time, they had a little bag packed, waiting by the front door, you know, for when the call might come in the night. And that image kind of really kind of resonated, that the bag packed, ready, you know, awaiting torture or Siberia or death. Now my mum recently has been, you know, has been really quite ill and depressed. A lot of her friends have been dying. My father, her husband, her sister, all died quite recently. She's really quite ill herself, so she's, you know, really been experiencing old age, sickness and death all around her. And recently she packed a little bag which she left in the hall, you know, ready for the call. And in Russia, you know, at that time I was talking about, the suffering of the people could really be laid directly at Stalin's door. But who does my mum blame? It's the human, you know, it's the human condition. A friend was telling me about this little sketch he did. I think he was in the Socialist Worker Party, and he did a sketch in the 80s with a friend. This was during the Tory government, and so there's two socialist workers standing selling papers, and one says to the other, "So how are you anyway?" And the other one says, "Well, actually, I'm a bit depressed. My hamster died last night." And the first one says, "Thatcher." Because at that time, Thatcher got the blame for everything. But we can't blame Margaret Thatcher or people like her for old age, sickness and death, as much as we'd like to. David Cameron is not responsible for the ageing process. It happens to everyone. And this was the Buddha's realization, wasn't it? This death, Channa, talking to the charioteer, this death, does it come to everybody? Yes, Lord, it comes to everybody. As part of my Russian phase, I'm reading about Leo Tolstoy. So not long after finishing War and Peace, you know, this great life-affirming novel, he had a visitor. So in a little hotel room, he became aware of somebody at his elbow. And this was death. He became aware of death. And for the rest of his long life, death was an ever-present visitor, you know, questioning him, mocking him, throwing up spiritual crises. And at the age of 50, he had a very great crisis. And he said, "My question, that which at the age of 50 brought me to the verge of suicide, was the simplest of questions, lying in the soul of every man, from the foolish child to the wisest elder. It was a question without an answer to which one cannot live, as I had found by experience. It was, why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? It can also be expressed thus, is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy?" So as part of reading about this, I was really interested to know that Tolstoy knew, and he seems to have really been quite influenced by the story of the Buddha. And in his confession he writes, "I, like Shakyamuni, could not ride out hunting when I knew that old age, suffering and death exist. My imagination was too vivid." And the rest of his life was involved with this question, you know, the question which all great literature and great art, poetry, music, and all religion, all great religion, or all the effective religion tries to answer. Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? So Siddhartha saw these first three sights, old age, sickness, death. He saw them, they were shattering, and nothing could ever be the same again. And we do get it from time to time to ourselves, don't we, to varying and lesser degrees. We wake up one morning and we just know for certain that one day we will die. You know, there are no loopholes. It's like W.C. Fields, you know, the great comedian. He was seen reading a Bible on his deathbed, which wasn't characteristic. And somebody asked him, "Bill, why are you reading the Bible?" And he said, "Looking for loopholes." But there are no loopholes. One of the first references to the four sights is in one of the long discourses of the Buddha in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha is recounting the life of a previous Buddha, Vipassi, And the Vipassi's life obviously mirrors the Buddha's own very closely. And as he was being driven to the pleasure park, Prince Vipassi saw an aged man bent like a roof beam, broken, leaning on a stick, tottering, sick, his youth all vanished. At the sight he said to the charioteer, "Charioteer, what is the matter with this man? His hair is not like other men's, his body is not like other men's. Prince, that is what is called an old man." But why is he called an old man? He is called old, Prince, because he has not long to live. But am I liable to become old and not exempt from old age? Both you and I, Prince, are liable to become old and are not exempt from old age. Well then, Charioteer, that will do for today with the pleasure park. Return now to the palace. "Very good, Prince," said the charioteer, and brought Prince Vipassi back to the palace. Arrived there, Prince Vipassi was overcome with grief and dejection, crying, "Shame in this thing birth, since to him who is born, old age must manifest itself." So there are various accounts of the four sights, and we heard some this morning. I think my own favourite is the light of Asia, and it's actually only the first three sites. He doesn't mention the fourth. As far as I know, it's the first really successful meeting between Western literature and Buddhism. And I think the best part of the poem concerns the prince's going forth, you know, this truly dramatic episode in Siddhartha's life. So I'll just read one little excerpt. "I see, I feel the vastness of the agony of earth, the vainness of its joys, the mockery of all its best, the anguish of its worst. Since pleasures end in pain, and youth in age, and love in loss, and life in hateful death, and death in unknown lives which will but yoke men to their wheel again, to whirl the round of false delights and woes that are not false, me too this lure hath cheated. So it seemed lovely to live, and life a sunlit stream, forever flowing in a changeless peace, whereas the foolish ripple of the flood dances so lightly down by bloom and lawn, only to pour its crystal quicklier into the foul, salt sea. The veil is rent which blinded me. I am as all these men who cry upon their gods and are not heard, or are not heeded, yet there must be aid. For them and me and all there must be help. Perchance the gods have need of help themselves, being so feeble that when sad lips cry they cannot save. I would not let one cry whom I could save. How can it be that Brahm would make a world and keep it miserable, since if all-powerful he leaves it so? He is not good, and if not powerful, he is not God. Channa, lead home again. It is enough. Mine eyes have seen enough." So we really see Siddhartha's agony, his conflict, and I think his heroism as well. He's a great hero in this poem. He's a great hero because he's challenging the gods. He's challenging God himself, Brahma. Why does God or the gods allow suffering? Could it be that there's no God? Could it be the gods themselves are so feeble that they need help? And this line, "I would not let one cry whom I could save." You know, it's blasphemous and it's human. It's saying, as we say, well, if I was God, I'd get my act together, really. He's taken on God. That's what I love about the Light of Asia and the story of the Buddha. There's a sense of someone searching for a human solution to the human predicament. And God, in a way, is irrelevant to that. So he's just about to depart the palace and leave Yashodhara. "I will depart," he spake, "the hour is come. Thy tender lips, dear sleeper, summon me to that which saves the earth but sunders us. And in the silence of yon sky, I read my fated message flashing. Unto this came I, and unto this all nights and days have led me. For I will not have that crown which may be mine. I lay aside those realms which wake the gleaming of my naked sword. My chariot shall not roll with bloody wheels from victory to victory till earth wears the red record of my name. I choose to tread its path with patient, stainless feet, making its dust my bed, its loneliest wastes my dwelling, and its meanest things my mates. clad in no prouder garb than outcasts wear, fed with no meat save what the charitable give of their will, sheltered by no more pomp than the dim cave lens of the jungle bush. This will I do because the woeful cry of life and all flesh living cometh up into my ears, and all my soul is full of pity for the sickness of this world, which I will heal, if healing may be found, by uttermost renouncing and strong strife. For which of all the great and lesser gods have power or pity? Who hath seen them? Who? So Light of Asia reminds me very much of a play. Now, I'm not talking about the delightful play that we saw earlier today. A particular play, a famous play. Anybody know what it might be? Hamlet. Which I saw at the Globe yesterday. It was a really, really good production. There's something quite Shakespearean about The Light of Asia, and I'm sure the author Sir Edwin Arnold was kind of steeped in Shakespeare. Siddhartha here is like a kind of hero from Shakespeare. And the verse form is the same as Shakespeare's, you know, iambic pentameter. Dum 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 dum. For now the hour is come when I should quit this golden prison where my heart lives caged. That's from Light of Asia, but just as much be Hamlet talking. Hamlet talks a lot about Denmark as a prison. His life in the royal palace is a prison. The time is out of joint, O wretched spite, that ever I was born to set it right. And that's from Hamlet. So I don't know if you all know the story of Hamlet, basically about the prince who's depressed, basically. His father's died, his mother has married his uncle with undue haste, and then he sees the ghost of his father. The ghost of his father says that he's been killed by his brother, Hamlet's uncle, and he demands that Hamlet take revenge, which Hamlet tries to do. But he can't. He's rendered inert. He thinks too much. His mind is just full of thoughts, and he can't act. When he does finally act, he kills the wrong person. Ophelia, who has been his lover, he kills Ophelia's father, Polonius. And this is part of what sends Ophelia insane. Ophelia drowns herself. Ophelia's brother comes, challenges Hamlet. Hamlet is challenged to a duel with Laertes, Ophelia's brother. So at the end of the play, there's four corpses on stage, and the two previous characters have also died. So it's a real tragedy, but there's a lot of resonances, I think, with the life of Siddhartha. In both cases, we have a great man, an heir to the throne, a prince who really sees suffering and becomes changed. In Hamlet's case, mad, or you're never quite sure if he's mad or not, but certainly changed. By virtue of his insight into suffering, by virtue of his profound intelligence, they're both alone, they're both isolated. You know, nobody understands what they're going through. In both Light of Asia and Hamlet, you've got the court, the royal court, with its empty pleasures. And beneath that, there's a smell of mortality, there's a smell of death, there's something rotten in the state. Everybody's ignoring the truth. And I really love that aspect of the Buddhist myth, you know, the king trying to hide suffering from his son, which could, if you reflect on it, could be really quite comic in the hands of somebody who could do that kind of thing. You know, I imagine him at the barber's having his white hairs dyed so that his son doesn't see the fact that he's aging, all that kind of thing. And there's lots of other links that with the other characters. But what sets them apart is Siddhartha acts, and Hamlet can't act. Hamlet, like Siddhartha, is very aware of the first three sights of old age, sickness and death. But unlike Siddhartha, he sees no fourth sight. Siddhartha's fourth sight was the holy man. The sadhu who provided the inspiration of the holy man. And I think this was one of the reasons there just wasn't enough in the literature and the drama I read at university to sustain me or build a life around. The fourth sight wasn't there enough. In some cases it wasn't there at all. And without the fourth sight, ultimately, you have Kurtz in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and the movie that was based on that, Apocalypse Now, with Marlon Brando. You have Kurtz in the depths of the jungle, surrounded by unspeakable suffering, like in a nightmare of suffering. And at the end, he just mutters the horror, the horror. In a sense, without the fourth sight, life is meaningless and horrifying. Obviously, it doesn't mean you can't get a huge amount from Joseph Conrad. And, I think I've seen Hamlet about 3 times in the last 6 months. And at the end, you're not depressed. It's actually quite joyful at the end, strangely. And the Globe, they do this great thing that after tragedies, they have a dance, which I love. And it doesn't seem weird. Why are they dancing after this tragedy? It almost seems a kind of, I don't know. I don't know why it works, but it works. There's something joyful about it, and I think that's my favourite moment in the play. But no fourth sight. And it's true of a lot of the writers and artists that I genuinely love, Philip Roth, Woody Allen. There's no sense of the spiritual or the transcendental. I was listening to an interview with Woody Allen, and he said one of the reasons he works so hard is to stop him thinking about the meaninglessness of existence. So presumably that's why his films are pervaded by this kind of underlying anxiety. You know, he's truly great at anxiety. But I find the films of somebody like the Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky more complete, because all the four sights are there. And my two favourite films are both by Tarkovsky. It's Andrei Rublev and Stalker. They're quite difficult films in a way, and I've introduced friends to them and they've fallen asleep. And so I wouldn't necessarily recommend them, but yes, I would. But they're great. And the Stalker, he's a guide who brings people into what's called the Zone. The Zone's a kind of wilderness area which has been cordoned off by the government. You know that something quite tragic or horrible has happened there. And the Stalker works as a guide, bringing people through the Zone, which is really quite dangerous, to the Room, which is said to grant the deepest, innermost wishes of anybody that goes in there. And the Stalker's clients in the film are a writer and a professor. The professor, I think he wants to win the Nobel Prize. The writer wants has lost his inspiration. He wants to regain his inspiration. Although the scientist, he's actually got a bomb with him. He wants to blow up the Room so that it doesn't fall into the hands of evil people. So the Stalker takes them in. There's a kind of physical and verbal sparring match, and the scientist, the professor, changes his mind about blowing up the Room. But eventually the two of them, the writer and the professor, refuse to go into the Room. They decide not to go into the Room. So the Stalker comes back home, and he's in despair, really. He's talking to his wife, he's crying, he's in tears. And he says, oh God, what people, haven't you seen them? They've got empty eyes. Can people like that believe in anything? And nobody believes, not only those two, nobody. Who am I going to take there, oh God? And what's most awful is that no one needs it. No one needs that Room. And all my efforts are just in vain. So you get a sense it's Tarkovsky talking, in a way. Because, the first, he did the film A Stalker twice. The first film was accidentally and destroyed by the laboratory. It was perhaps something to do with the government. He had to start all over again. But the beautiful films, they kind of open up into beauty and a sense of the miraculous and the magical and the spiritual. And his other film, Andrei Rublev, was produced in the same year as Bonnie and Clyde, and a film which suggests that we're spiritually and ethically at sea. You know, we find ourselves identifying with these killers, very much no fourth sight. But I think that's what I really like about Russian literature and films, that there's a sense that there's meaning to be sought. Even if not to be found, the quest is there, the quest is important. And often you get characters in Russian stories really grappling with spiritual and religious questions. You know, in Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn, even Anton Chekhov, who's great on boredom. He's really good on boredom. You know, the meaninglessness, the spiritual lack, and the boredom of people's lives. But some of his characters have these hard-won spiritual epiphanies and create a sense of meaning for themselves. And this kind of boredom, this spiritual ennui, this sense of meaninglessness, you really get a sense of it in Hamlet as well. You know, what are you reading, my lord? Words, words, words. And I think in any elucidation of Siddhartha's story, that sense of boredom and meaninglessness would have to figure quite strongly. The utter tedium of life in the palace, where you seemingly have everything, but actually you don't have anything. So Sangharakshita quotes H.G. Wells as saying that Siddhartha's boredom was that of a fine mind seeking employment. And you get that in Chekhov, all these fine minds without employment. And occasionally they rouse themselves and they have a big speech, you know, I must work, I must make meaning in my life, or I shall shoot myself, I shall hang myself in the barn. But more often than not, they don't have the kind of sustaining vision or the inspiration to go and search for meaning. You know, they just have another cup of tea from the samovar. But Siddhartha saw the holy man. And again, in my school visits, you know, as I say, I mentioned the sites. But I don't spend as much time in the fourth site. Perhaps it's a bit more difficult to convey, you know, this mysterious holy man. But actually, for the legend to work, for the myth to work as a myth, the fourth site must have been just as shattering as the other three. You know, it sustained Siddhartha throughout all these years of searching. It motivated him to leave his wife and his child. It motivated him to leave everything he knew and loved. So what did he see? You know, in some accounts it's just a holy man walking mindfully. The way I explain it to the kids is that that this man had nothing. He was in dirty rags. He just had a bowl. But he looked incredibly happy. There was something in his eyes that really attracted Siddhartha. And when Siddhartha asked him what he did, he said he went searching for the truth. So something about the man persuaded Siddhartha that the truth could be found. You know, something in the way he walked, the power of the walk, something in his eyes, his expression. I think what you saw in the holy man was that this man had also seen the three sights, old age, sickness and death, but he could hold them in his heart. He could hold the tension. He had something which made the kind of terrible knowledge bearable, and he could respond with kindness. Siddhartha realised that this man could see in the dark. You know, he'd gone into the heart of darkness but was still alive, and he could respond with kindness. So suffering can be can just seem really overwhelming at times, can't it? And the world's so small. We're so obviously interconnected these days. Disasters at the other side of the globe affect us in all sorts of ways. And with that comes a huge anxiety. The media fuels it, it feeds off our anxiety. After the tsunami in Japan, the nuclear accident, I was just passing the shop and one of the headlines said, apocalypse. And obviously, just immediately it kind of latches into your fear, your anxiety. And that's why we need the fourth sight, that inspiration, so that we don't respond with horrified anxiety, but with compassion, so that we'll be able to see in the dark. Other ways of talking about it are, you know, developing faith and confidence in the three jewels, going for refuge more deeply, strengthening the first stage of the Noble Eightfold Path, you know, that perfect vision which convinces us that there's such a thing as insight and enlightenment, you know, that beneath terrible suffering lies a great and mysterious and compassionate reality, an awareness which is by its nature kindly. We talk about kindly awareness, but awareness is by its nature kindly. So the fourth sight is absolutely necessary to the story of the Buddha. Without it, Siddhartha would have despaired. So here's a poem by R.S. Thomas. It's called The Bright Field. I have seen the sun break through to illuminate a small field for a while and gone my way and forgotten it. But that was the pearl of great price, the one field that had the treasure in it. I realise now that I must give all that I have to possess it. Life is not hurrying on to a receding future, nor hankering after an imagined past. It is the turning aside like Moses to the miracle of the lit bush, to a brightness that seemed as transitory as your youth once, but is the eternity that awaits you. So I think this is a lovely poem. I think it's a really useful poem. I'm kind of reticent to explain it away, but you could say that the bright field is perfect vision, the fourth sight, which incorporates a sense of eternity. You know, without that, we're trapped in linear time. Especially as we grow older, we find we're facing a receding future, or we regret the past, all the things we didn't do, haven't done, wished we'd done. But no, this isn't the only way, or even the most useful way of considering our lives. You know, consider the bright field, the eternity that can await you, to use kind of eternalist language. In Buddhist terms, with mindfulness, that bright field is accessible to us every moment of every day, if we can be aware, if we can let go of anxiety for the future and regret for the past. Just stop. So Siddhartha, after seeing the four sights, entered the forest, which was a terrible place, you know, a place of darkness and danger and hunger. He entered the heart of darkness. And the fourth sight gave him the inspiration to face the other three, to go into that heart of darkness. He faced suffering. He looked at the human condition. He stared into the eyes of the old man and the sick man and the corpse. But he also remembered the eyes of the holy man. And in entering the heart of darkness and turning and fully facing suffering, a great compassion was born. His own heart eventually opened. Like a great flower, he became enlightened. I'll just read another extract from The Light of Asia. In Shakespeare, you often have these speeches about how the natural world reflects the action in the play. You know, in Macbeth, for example, you have all this really weird weather, terrible things happening in nature, which seem to mirror all the evil things that are going on in the play. And in Light of Asia, a similar thing happens, but in a beautiful way, as the Buddha becomes enlightened, as his desire to help humanity and destroy suffering becomes manifest. You know, nature mirrors the event in a magnificent dawn. Devas in the air cried, "It's finished, finished." And the priests stood with the wondering people in the streets, watching those golden splendours flood the sky and saying, "There hath happened some mighty thing." Also in Ran and jungle grew that day friendship amongst the creatures. Spotted deer browsed fearless where the tigress fed her cubs, and cheetahs lapped the pool beside the bucks. Under the eagle's rock the brown hares scoured while his fierce beak but preened an idle wing. The snake sunned all his jewels in the beam with deadly fangs in sheath. Around the perch, the spirit of our Lord lay potent upon man and bird and beast. Even while he mused under that Bodhi tree, glorified with the conquest gained for all, enlightened by a light greater than day's. Then he arose, radiant, rejoicing, strong, beneath the tree, and lifting high his voice, spake this, in hearing of all times and worlds: "Many a house of life hath held me, seeking ever him who wrought these prisons of the senses, sorrow-fraught. Sore was my ceaseless strife. But now, thou builder of this tabernacle, thou, I know thee, never shalt thou build again these walls of pain, nor raise the roof-tree of deceits, nor lay fresh rafters on the clay. Broken thy house is, and the ridge-pole split. Delusion fashioned it. Safe pass I thence, deliverance to obtain." So stories and myth are undervalued. The word myth is often synonymous with a lie, you know, just a myth. But we've got things the wrong way around. We value and trust the chaos of real life over myth and story because it seems literally true. We value the literal and rational and scientifically proven over the fabulous, over the fable. But in doing that, we're betrayed by surfaces. What's really going on can only or more truly be explained by the drama, the story, the legend, which lies underneath literal objective truth. So myth and story are how we organise the chaos of our lives into meaningful patterns and dramatic events. They're indispensable. "Myths," said Rollo May, "are like the beams in a house. Not exposed to outside view, they are the structure which holds the house together so people can live in it. And the greater the story, the more it moves towards the status of myth and legend, the more it can resonate in the hearts of all people at all times." The writer Ben Okri said, "We are homo fabula, storytelling creatures." And my friend Kovida, who's unfortunately not in the order anymore, he did this great little drama exercise once, and I can't remember the story now, but we told it again and again and again and again in a group of about 20 of us. And what we found is that if the person who was telling the story was connected to the story, if he didn't kind of back off from it or, you know, get bored, was actually connected to it and communicated to it, the rest of us just weren't bored at all. We still found it interesting, even after, you know, 15, 16 times. There's something about story that just kind of really, really fascinates us. Ben Oakley wrote an interesting little essay called The Joys of Storytelling. It's full of little aphorisms. I'll just read a few of them. We are part human, part stories. That's one I like. What else? Without stories, we would go mad. Life would lose its moorings or lose its orientations. Even in silence, we are living out our stories. Stories can drive you mad. Stories can heal profound sicknesses of the spirit. A good story keeps on growing. A good story never dies. Stories can destroy civilizations, can win wars, can lose them, can conquer hearts by the millions, can transform enemies into friends, can help the sick towards healing, can sow the seeds of the creation of empires, can undo them, can reshape the psychic mould of a people, can remould the political and spiritual temper of an age. I'm not referring to just any story, but only to those great ones, rich and rare, that haunt, that elude, that tantalise, that have the effect of poignant melodies lodged deep in barely reachable places of the spirit. The human race is not blessed with many stories of this quality. So it's an interesting and enjoyable exercise to reflect on the stories that we're really attracted to and influenced us or changed us or terrified us or inspired us. You know, the movies, the novels, the dreams even. Because I'm sure you're the same. Often I'll wake up and I've just had a sense all night I've had this epic dream. I can only remember little fragments of it. I'd love to remember the whole kind of epic dream. And occasionally those kind of dreams have kind of changed me. I've only time to mention one story which particularly influenced me, and that's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which many of you might have read or seen the movie. And there was a time when I was a Christian for a while. I'd been involved with the Iona community, which I really loved. I met some really great people there, but eventually I realised I didn't believe in God. I hadn't quite committed myself to Buddhism. I went on a long retreat. I was in a real state. And one of the things I did, this story just kept coming to mind again and again and again. You know, about Randall McMurphy, this kind of anarchic criminal who kind of challenges the authorities. He challenges the other inmates in the institution that he lives in. There's something quite kind of anarchic and attractive about them. Eventually he's kind of destroyed, but in that kind of tragedy, his friend is able to kind of liberate himself, to free himself. And somehow in going over this story over and over again, I think it helped bridge this kind of rather dangerous chasm between two great narratives, you know, the narrative that I'd left behind of Christianity and the other narrative that wasn't quite yet born of Buddhism. So that story was one that was incredibly important to me. It had elements of myth. It wasn't a myth, but like all great stories, I think it had elements of myth. And it was personal to me in a way. I don't mean that other people wouldn't get something out of it, but I used it in a personal way at a particular time in my life. It wouldn't necessarily sustain me in my deathbed. You know, a myth is a story which can influence a whole society, country, and beyond. It offers a profound sense of significance and meaning. But we don't have many shared myths these days. You know, Woody Allen makes films and works hard to avoid facing up to the meaninglessness of life. I don't mean to denigrate him because I think he's done some really excellent and intelligent films. But unlike Andrei Tarkovsky, the filmmaker, he has no sense that he's attempting to communicate spiritual values through story, to move towards the mythical. This writer, Rollo May, he says, the barrenness of our culture with respect to ethical values rests upon the barrenness of myths, which means many of us have no faith to live by. So he says that we're forced to do deliberately for ourselves what in previous ages was done by the family or the church or the state, namely form the myths by which we make sense of our lives. and make sense of experience. You know, we get something from that novel there, that movie there, that book there. We scramble together some kind of myth to live by. But as Buddhists, we don't have to do that so much. Hallelujah. Because we have to, you know, at hand we have a story of great profundity and meaning, a myth. It doesn't mean we don't have to work very hard to emotionally connect with that myth, you know, to understand it or communicate it. We need to find connections with our own culture. We need to find the right words and images. You know, I just keep recalling my own difficulty with the radio play and trying to communicate the story of the Buddha. I kind of failed in a way. I didn't have enough heartfelt connections somehow. It hadn't seeped into my being enough. It isn't easy. But the story of the Buddha, the myth of the Buddha, can offer a template for our lives. It can be told to us in our deathbeds. You know, just as the image of the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree is a kind of visual touchstone for our lives, so the story of the Buddha is a kind of narrative, mythical touchstone by which we can understand the events of our lives. And it doesn't mean we have to take the story literally. You know, we don't have to live the story in a literal sense, otherwise we'd be leaving our wives, husbands, children, which would be absurd. But a Buddhist, in attempting to discover meaning in life, reenacts the spirit of the story. And with its themes of facing up to suffering, of rejecting violence, of rejecting both hedonism and self-mortification, of supreme altruism and love, it's a myth, you know, which seems particularly appropriate for our age. And one of the reasons this myth seems so appropriate to us today, you know, immersed as we are in financial insecurity and a great environmental crisis, is it's a narrative of personal responsibility. It's a human story. You know, there's no God to defer to cry out to, or even to blame. And above all, the myth of the Buddha is so significant because ultimately it challenges us to reenact the experience of the Buddha under the Tree of Enlightenment. We are capable of discovering the meaning which the Buddha discovered. We can overcome what the Buddha overcame. We can become Buddhas. Okay, so I'm just drawing to a close now. There's a Chekhov story called The Student, which was actually his favourite story. And in it, a young student meets a couple of peasant women on some desolate winter evening around a bonfire. And the student tells these peasant women part of the Christian story, part of the Easter story, and they're utterly captivated. They weep, and the past and the present merge. You know, the story has a relevance to these people now. They're moved by it. It gives their lives meaning. And this is how the story ends. He glanced back. The solitary fire calmly flickered in the darkness, and no one was visible near it. Once again, the student reflected that since Vasily had wept and her daughter had been deeply touched, then obviously what he had just been telling them about events centuries ago had some significance for the present, for both women, for this village, for himself and for all people. That old woman had wept, but not at his moving narrative. It was because Peter was close to her and because she was concerned from the bottom of her heart with his most intimate feelings. His heart suddenly thrilled with joy, and he even stopped for a moment to catch his breath. The past, he thought, is linked to the present by an unbroken chain of events, each flowing from the other. He felt that he just witnessed both ends of the chain. When he touched one end, the other started shaking. After crossing the river by ferry and climbing the hill, he looked at his native village and towards the west, where a narrow strip of cold crimson sunset was glimmering. And he reflected how truth and beauty, which had guided human life there in the garden in the high priest's palace and had continued unbroken to the present, were the most important parts of the life of man and of the whole of terrestrial life. A feeling of youthfulness, health, strength, he was only 22, and an inexpressibly sweet anticipation of happiness, of a mysterious, unfamiliar happiness, gradually took possession of him, and life seemed entrancing, wonderful, and endowed with sublime meaning. So we don't know what happened 2,500 years ago in the forest in North India. A man broke through into a higher dimension of consciousness. It's mysterious. He's too close to us in a way. He looks too much like us, and he's too far away. This experience seems at times far, far beyond us. But if he hadn't broken through, our lives would be very different. The story of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, the Awakened One, can inform more and more of our lives if we let it. There is an unbroken chain between past and present. His story can be of the utmost relevance and meaning to us. And it's a human story, a story which tells us that with courage and perseverance and kindness we can become like him, we can break through. Not just one great breakthrough, but small breakthroughs, meaningful episodes until eventually our whole life can become imbued with the deepest significance. Thank you.